Hello, I'm Dr. Fernando Martinez, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity entitled Teaming Up to Manage Patients with COPD, a Plan to Streamline Care. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters. It's an award-winning, accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians across the globe. Also, today's program has been designed to meet both the requirements of MOC and as a MIPS improvement activity. But your active participation requires some specific components. That includes answering polling questions, asking questions, completing the evaluation and post-test. This is the first step in the process. After today's program, incorporate the clinical improvements we will discuss, and they're going to give you some very explicit recommendations. And in 2 to 3 months, CME Outfitters will send you a survey to complete, which will fulfill a data collection requirement. You'll then receive a confirmation you can submit to CMS. It's that easy. Our goal of today's activity is really to help you safely and effectively improve the lives of your patients with COPD. Now, to get started, as I mentioned, I'm Fernando Martinez. I am the Chief of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. I'm looking forward to being with you today. It'll be our goal to not only improve the diagnosis of COPD, but to share the latest evidence to help you assess and treat your patients with COPD. And optimal care for this patient population really requires a team approach that includes pulmonary physicians, primary care clinicians. Our panel today reflects that paradigm. And in fact, let me introduce some of our panel so you can see the diversity that we have. So Meilan Han is the director of the Michigan Airways Program in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Medicine at the University of Michigan Health System in Ann Arbor. Welcome, Meilan.
Thank you, Fernando.
And a card-carrying primary care clinician here, Dr. Matthew Mintz, who is a clinical associate professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C., but also has a very busy primary care practice. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So it's important for us to have an understanding of what we're going to talk about. And so that means that we've got to be able to define our learning objectives. And so the first objective is to apply evidence-based treatment guidelines for your treatment decisions for patients with COPD. So there's going to be an evidence-based component. Next, we're going to discuss throughout the program sort of multidisciplinary approaches that optimize continuity of care between primary care, pulmonary specialists, and this care continuum for our patients with COPD. And finally, we're going to discuss a lot of data on how to select inhaled treatments for our patients with COPD. And again, we're going to use evidence-based, we're going to talk about delivery devices, how to assess symptoms, how to define exacerbation risk, and so on. So it's going to be a pretty comprehensive approach. There are a couple of kind of cool things that I want you to keep in mind. We're going to be using throughout the presentation some really cool animation that sort of gives us a sense of lung function and some of the concepts. We're only going to show you a few of them today, but you'll have access to really all of them to be able to use. And so, you guys, that makes sense?
Yep.
All right, getting ready to go? All right, so with that in mind, we're going to sort of begin the process, and we're going to give us a sense of, from the very, very earliest portion of how we deal with a COPD patient. And what I'd like to be able to do is to start off with just the concept of what is COPD. So, Meilan, I'm going to punt that one over to you first.
It's been argued that COPD actually isn't one disease. It's actually a collection of larger, of multiple diseases. But we group them together in that I think these patients have similar risk factors, either to tobacco or other occupational exposures. But they're all defined by airflow obstruction. But in order to measure that, you have to get spirometry. And unfortunately, that means we have a lot of patients in this country who are probably both undiagnosed and misdiagnosed.
Yeah. All right. So this is an important concept that we're going to come back to as we go through the program. So that is, COPD is a diagnosis that generally requires the confirmation of chronic obstruction. And so, Matthew, your sense from the primary care setting, how frequently do you think that actually takes place?
Probably not frequently enough. I think with the definition, we need to, the definition and the diagnosis, probably still stands the test of time, but I think we have to broaden our horizons and get out of the mindset of that classic pink pluffer, blue bloater that we learned in medical school, because we're probably missing a large number of patients. But that assessment of lung flow obstruction really needs to be done with spirometry, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But really, that's something that we can do in the primary care office, and we'll talk a little bit about that.
All right. So you've heard a couple of the concepts. So the concept of what COPD is and what it takes to diagnose COPD. But both of you have highlighted the issue of the challenge in diagnosis and the resulting sort of burden of undiagnosed COPD. Meilan, you've actually published in this area. Can you give us a quick little summary for our primary care clinicians out there?
So it turns out that the burden of undiagnosed COPD actually is pretty high. So it's estimated about 7 to 8% prevalence for chronic airflow obstruction in the U.S. and roughly about 16 million patients that were diagnosed. Unfortunately, that's probably only half the total population.
It's a pretty big number.
Because it's estimated that roughly half the patients in the U.S. actually don't even have a diagnosis. So it's a big problem.
Yep. All right. But that's, so it's important to then to understand that, as you pointed out, you know, we have a sense of what COPD is, and we also have a sense that COPD is not frequently diagnosed. With that concept, and so thinking back to what we've all learned in medical school and some of the evolution of our thoughts over time, it was usually thought that COPD was smokers, a smoker disease. You know, if you don't smoke, okay, you know, COPD can't be the diagnosis. Can you give us some sense of what the more recent data are in that respect? Meilan, I'm going to turn that over to you, and then I'm going to ask you a related question to that, Matthew.
So it's interesting. Roughly a quarter of patients who have COPD actually are never smokers, and there's likely a huge variety of things that led to that. Interestingly, a higher proportion of that group are female. So these may be patients that were misdiagnosed as asthma, but there's probably also a group of patients in there that maybe had respiratory trauma as a child, or have worked in a dusty job, or had secondhand smoke exposure. It's like a mix of patients that ended up in that bucket.
So Matthew, you deal with, and you do a lot of work in this arena with your primary care colleagues, that concept that COPD is not just all smoking anymore. What would be the bullet that you would want your primary care clinicians to remember?
Oh, I'll give you two.
Two bullets for the price of one.
So one is that it's not just smoking, but past history of smoking.
Yeah.
If we just ask, oh, do you smoke, you know, we may miss those patients. Most of the patients now that I'm diagnosing with COPD have quit for many years, and now that they have that normal progression of lung function decline, now you're starting to see symptomatology.
Right. Right.
So I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing is looking at some of the symptoms, the cough, the phlegm, the sputum production, which is the common sort of symptomatology that patients present with. But it's really that bronchitis that happens 3 or 4 times a year.
Yeah.
That should clue clinicians in, you know, you're not supposed to get bronchitis 3 or 4 times a year. I mean, that patient may actually have COPD, and that's when you need to start asking questions about symptomatology and then trying to objectively assess that with lung function.
Oh, it's perfect. So think about what Matthew has just told you in terms of some of the sort of the key little pearls. And Meilan, what I want you to do at this point would be to incorporate some of those concepts into providing very explicit recommendations on this is how you diagnose COPD.
Well, we have to get spirometry to diagnose COPD. So that means when the patient gets that spirometry done, you'll get a measurement of the forced expiratory volume in the first second. And you look at the ratio of that to the forced vital capacity total. And when patients have a reduced ratio, that's usually defined as 0.7 after bronchodilator, that's indicative of the presence of airflow obstruction. So if you have a patient where they've got the risk factors, they may be a little bit older, they've got symptoms, it's definitely something you need to think about. Because, you know, the other possibility is they have something else. It's just important to nail down the correct diagnosis.
Yeah, so assessment of symptoms, understanding exposures, and Matthew's given you a broader sense of some of this exposure component, I think are key components. Matthew, you're in a busy primary care practice these days, can you give us a sense of what are sort of some of the key indicators that you would like your colleagues to come away with at the end of this section of the presentations?
Well, again, as I mentioned, sort of the key things that we think about with COPD: dyspnea, chronic cough, production of sputum.
Okay.
And most patients will have that, but they may not have all of those things. So you may have someone with a chronic cough that doesn't have any sputum production. So you don't have to have all of those things.
Okay.
And as I mentioned before, there are other things that you need to take into account.
Yep.
Family history, low birth weight, history of childhood infections can even play a role. Not only, as I mentioned, former smoking, but you know, exposure to secondhand smoke, exposure to different environments. And again, as I mentioned, those frequent lower respiratory tract infections, that I think is one of the things that we tend to, oh, well, they just have another cold. And after the fourth or fifth time, we should say, wait a second, this may actually be COPD.
All right, so let me pose a separate question related to this. And that is, I got 30 patients I got to see today, and you know, I got to leave a little early. So I want to be able to ask some of these questions quickly. Mm. What would you say would be sort of the key way that you would give your primary care colleagues sort of pearls of how you do this in a rapid fashion to get that assessment started?
Right. I think there are a lot of barriers that we have to making this diagnosis. I think on the patient side, because the disease is such a chronic, slow progressive disease, patients really underappreciate how severe they are, because it's you know, it's the whole how do you boil a frog in water kind of process. And you know, they don't realize that they're sick. They've just sort of accommodated or gotten accustomed to low-level activity. So really assessing what their function is. So to try to overcome that barrier, you know, what do you do? What did you used to do? And is there a change? Can you do regular activities? That's one thing. From a provider standpoint, it's the time. And when you're busy in primary care, you're trying to see so many patients a day, it's really hard. Yeah. So it's not just asking about smoking. It's asking about, did you have any other exposure to smoke? Were you a former smoker? And then those symptomatology questions.
All right. So it's pretty straightforward. I mean, he's given you a really nice summary of those components. Milan, both of you have stated several times the issue of spirometry in terms of the diagnostic component. Can you give us a sense of spirometry in a really simple, bulleted fashion?
So I think we were chatting earlier, and Matt was explaining to me just how easy it actually is to do in the office. I have the luxury of a pulmonary function testing lab right next to me, but even in Matt's busy primary care office, it can be practical. The devices are quite small, and it doesn't take a lot of time, but it really is required to establish the diagnosis. Again, we look at that at that ratio, and then we look at the FEV1 itself and how low that percent predicted is to grade severity of disease.
So Matthew, How do you recommend that people in the primary care who busy practice, got a lot of patients, got multiple comorbid illnesses, incorporate spirometry?
Yeah, I think if I would implore my colleagues to really consider incorporating spirometry in their practice. I think it's not very common in most primary care settings, and I think there's a couple of reasons for that.
Yeah.
One is that in our training, at least in inpatient setting, this was not something that we saw done in primary care routinely, so we're not as comfortable with it as opposed to like an EKG where we do all the time. Most primary care physicians have an EKG machine in their practice, do it on a regular basis, though I'm not really clear on how much value that EKG actually provides.
Won't even go there.
You know, and then the other thing is that in our minds we have sort of the old technology with these big, bulky, clunky machines.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really changed in the past few years. I mean, the technology's gotten easier. It's not very hard to do. In fact, as I was telling you earlier, my EKG machine and spirometry machine are one and the same. I have one box
that
does both functions. So it's really not that hard to do. It's not hard to maintain. And the other thing that I would add for my primary care colleagues is this is a billable procedure.
Yeah.
There's not too many procedures that we have in primary care, and CMS will reimburse for that. So this is something that, and I'm not suggesting you get this just to have a billable procedure, but rather this, you know, unlike an EKG, you need spirometry for the diagnosis and management of both COPD and asthma, which are both important in primary care. So this is something, if you have not looked into it recently, I would encourage you to relook because I think this is something that all primary care physicians should be able to do. It's not that hard.
EKG and spirometry at the same time.
It's perfect. It's great. It's one machine. It takes up less space.
So, Milan, all these numbers that come out, what should I know to be able to make that diagnosis easily in a short period of time?
Yeah, I really only, there's a lot of numbers, and I'm not saying they aren't important, but the easiest way to view it is to think about the FEV1, the FVC, and the ratio. If the ratio is reduced, and it's usually defined by less than 0.7, you have obstruction, and then you look at the FEV1 itself to define the severity of the obstruction.
Yep.
I think it can be just shocking and fascinating. I had a patient recently who had never had pulmonary function testing in his life. His primary care doc noted that he was short of breath, sent him to me in pulmonary, and he had an FEV1 of 25% predicted first time he'd gotten it. So that's not the typical patient, but I think there are a lot of patients out there where severity is underestimated.
So Milan just gave you a physiology lesson in spirometry in 15 seconds. So you realize how easy it is to do these guys.
If I can understand, it's so easy.
The next concept that I want to break, because we're going to sort of do this in a series of components, is to give you a sense of what GOLD, which is the Global Obstructive Lung Diseases, it's a group that Meilan and I have been involved in for a while, has recommended in its therapeutic strategy. So the idea, and Matthew, you've already hinted to this in your discussion so far, is that the diagnosis, you guys have been pretty clear, history, symptoms, and spirometry. And the concepts that were introduced by GOLD was that as we make therapeutic decisions for patients, it is vitally important that we take into account sort of multiple components. And so you can look in the slide and you see the left-hand side is what Meilan and Matt have said, the spirometry, the ratio less than 0.7 is obstruction and so on. But the right-hand panel, which is the approach that has been recommended by at least this group for therapeutic decision-making, is based on sort of two concepts. The concept of assessing symptoms. And so the bottom on the right-hand side, you see the MMRC and CAT. Matthew's going to talk about that in a second. Those are measures of symptoms. And then the exacerbation history as a predictor of exacerbation risk. So those two concepts are really the two concepts that are now being advocated as really important paradigm components. With that in mind, you're a busy primary care kind of guy. If I look, show you this and go, all right, Matthew, this is a recommendation of this particular group for assessment and therapeutic decision making. How do you assess symptoms and what do you think of the approaches?
Well, I think what's nice about the paradigm is while it looks complicated on the slide, it's actually quite simple. And that basically you're looking at two components, really. You're looking at exacerbations, you're looking at symptomatology, yep. And you can really box people in four boxes, which we'll know we'll go into detail in a little bit. So it actually makes it pretty easy. We like to try to keep things as simple and as simple as possible, right, in primary care because we are so busy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think it makes it easy. When looking at symptomatology, you mentioned two tools, the CAT and the MMRC.
Yep.
These are standardized, validated tools that give credence to the evidence behind this recommendation. In primary care, though, it's really hard for us to have these validated instruments and ask all these questions. So my preference is actually the MMRC because it's intuitive. It's a 5-point scale where grade 0 is basically, you know, shortness of breath with only strenuous activity. Grade 1 is a little bit of shortness of breath with a little extra activity. And once you hit grade 2, whereas essentially you have more breathlessness than your peers or just walking for a little bit gives you a little bit of breathlessness, that's sort of the cutoff. And so, you know, our colleagues can read the slide. You don't have to have this tool in your office. You don't have to sort of memorize it. But if you can keep in your mind that cutoff for symptomatology is walking slower than people of the same age on level because of breathlessness or having to stop at my own pace because shortness of breath, that sort of clarifies that cutoff point. And so you don't have to have a piece of paper in your office or an EMR. It's sort of very intuitive of who's symptomatic and who's not.
I love that way. It's very practical. So just as a side note, Meilan and I are involved in a multi-center trial right now for case finding. And we had a long discussion regarding how much burden there would be by putting the MMRC. And the eventual conclusion was, just put question
just
two.
Question two.
That's exactly right.
Question two.
We listened to you, primary care folks, because that's exactly what the thought was. So Meilan, the symptom component is clearly one of the important paradigms that's present in the recommendations now. Can you give me your insights regarding sort of symptoms and why you think GOLD has incorporated the symptomatic domain for patient evaluation?
Well, I think when we're going to be talking about pharmacologic therapy in a few minutes here, but when we think about what treatment can do, it can definitely improve symptoms and it can also improve exacerbations, and that's what we're talking about in just a second. So, it used to be all we did was look at the FEV1, and while it certainly is related to symptoms and exacerbations, in an individual patient, there may not be a perfect tight one-to-one connection, and that's why GOLD made that decision to split the spirometric severity from symptoms and exacerbations, because in any one patient, you could have very low FEV1 and perhaps not so bad on symptoms. Another patient look great on FEV1, but have horrible exacerbations and really bad symptoms.
Yeah. All right, so symptoms, crucially important component. I love your question too, got that. Matthew, the next component that the GOLD, and just for our audience, GOLD is a multinational group of individuals that's pulmonary primary care that have generated a series of therapeutic strategies over the years. So it's called the Global Obstructive Lung Disease, GOLD, Science Committee. And so Meilan and I happen to be sitting on that science committee now. So GOLD has taken the route of symptoms and exacerbations. Can you give our audience sort of a sense of why exacerbations are important and how some of the thresholds have been defined.
Absolutely. So, you know, exacerbation by definition is an acute worsening of symptoms where additional therapy is required. It is a key and critical component of COPD. The parallel that I like to use is cardiovascular disease. So we think of atherosclerosis as the disease and the sentinel event is the heart attack. Yeah. And so in my mind, an exacerbation is like the heart attack for COPD.
Yep. Love it.
And just with a heart attack where you know you have an increased risk for future heart attacks, and if you have that heart attack, the heart never recovers fully, you have the same thing that happens with COPD, where if you're an exacerbator, if you have an COPD exacerbation, you're at risk for future exacerbations. In fact, the strongest predictor. And then also you can have worsening lung function. And then as we'll see in just a minute, exacerbations come with a number of negative sequelae that can have downstream complications.
Yeah, I know. I love the correlation to the cardiology analogy. I think that's a great analogy. The goal, this Global Obstructive Lung Disease group has recommended identifying individuals at risk for being frequent exacerbators. Can you give us a sense of what that would mean,
exactly.
Frequent exacerbators?
So exacerbations, like I mentioned, have a bunch of negative sequelae. So lower quality of life, faster disease progression, increased risk for hospitalization, as I mentioned, increased risk for another exacerbation. And most importantly, the more exacerbations you have, there's actually a correlation with mortality.
Yeah.
So it's more than just symptomatology. Yep. It's a whole consequence of the disease. And it's really something that we should focus on, seeing what we do to prevent exacerbations.
So you guys are seeing the consistent theme, symptoms, exacerbation. So now let me go back to this global obstructive lung disease strategy. I'm just going to highlight one component just to summarize, and then I'm going to pose to you, Milan, a question that you summarize for our audience, how to incorporate both of those components potentially to make therapeutic decisions. That's the next step. So to remind you, diagnosis is based on spirometry. Take a deep breath and blow it out hard. The amount of air you blow out in the first second, forced expired volume in 1 second. The amount that you blow out in the whole maneuver is forced vital capacity. You divide those two. Less than 0.7 ratio, obstruction. That's what Milan showed you earlier. So that's what the FEV1 reflects. The level of severity of obstruction is really the FEV1 that we compare to. But most importantly is from a therapeutic decision making. It's the mixture of symptoms and exacerbations. Can you walk folks through that right-hand panel, Milan?
Right. So Gold, as I mentioned, made this decision to kind of separate the lung function from symptoms and exacerbations. And like I said, I think it makes a lot of sense because there may be a disconnect in any one patient. So when you're looking at that ABCD panel, the low symptoms are on the left. That's your A and C group. Your high symptoms on the right. That's your B and D group. And you can use CAT or Matt's one question version of the MMRC. And then the top versus the bottom half of the panel is all about risk for exacerbation. So if you've had zero or one exacerbation that did not require hospitalization, that puts you in the low-risk group. If you've had at least one hospitalization for an exacerbation or at least two outpatient events, that puts you in a high-risk group for having future events, and that's how people end up in the ABCD.
Yeah, and so initially we thought this ABCD was going to be too complicated. Oh, my God, four quadrants and all of this rigmarole, Matthew. When you're talking to your primary care colleagues, realizing that we're just about to get into management, we're about halfway through, and it's exactly that point when we get into management, how do you want them to conceptualize this idea of ABCD, sort of the two components?
Yeah, like I mentioned before, we like to keep things simple in primary care, and this has really helped us keep things simple. It basically puts us into, we think about two things, reduction of risk and reduction of symptoms. And symptoms, it's not just, you know, dyspnea, shortness of breath, but also health status.
Yeah.
What are they able to do? With reduction of risk, it's preventing these exacerbations, and which again may be correlated with mortality. So, you know, I mentioned cardiovascular disease. You know, a very good parallel was we used to focus in cholesterol management. We used to focus on the numbers,
on the level.
What's the LDL, et cetera. Now the newer thinking is what's the patient's risk.
Yeah.
And you look at their risk, and regardless of what their numbers are, that risk determines whether they're on a high-potency statin or a moderate-potency statin. This is a very big parallel.
So
if a patient is at risk, they go higher up that quadrant for a different pharmacotherapy, which we'll talk about in a second.
Oh, I love it. My old mentor said that pulmonary people were frustrated at cardiologists. So now you're giving us all the points in that respect. All right, so now let's switch over. We're about halfway through, so let's switch over now to management. And so that as a busy primary care guy, can you give me a sense of how you would conceptualize, sort of broadly generating what you would think, Matthew, would be the principles for management?
So again, as we said, risk, of disease, risk of exacerbation, and symptomatology. And so thinking about those two parameters, where they fall on that spectrum, and then trying to target therapy to those two different components. And as the slide shows, I mean, we have to try to manage sort of the risk and benefits of the treatments, you know, and everything that we do in medicine is benefiting, is risk benefit. So we have to look at how well does the therapy help with symptoms? How well does the therapy help with reducing exacerbations, you know, improving lung function versus some of the problems either in taking the medication and using the medication or maybe even some of the side effects. So where I know we're going to talk a little bit about pneumonia as a potential problem and how do you balance that? So everything that we do is really in any therapeutic area, but specific, but also COPD is trying to weigh those risks and balances, risk and benefits of what to choose for a patient.
Perfect. So you've seen sort of two broad concepts: symptom reduction, exacerbation reduction, risk reduction. So those are the two key concepts. And then the idea of risk benefit, you'll see that these two are going to discuss that with specific therapeutic approaches, which then leads me to the next question, Melan. As we think about what pharmacotherapeutic approaches we have, there are a whole bunch of things on this slide. Can you give our audience sort of a really succinct summary of what's available?
So there are a lot of things on that slide, but the number of classes we have is actually still pretty limited. So there are bronchodilators, and in that we have two types of bronchodilators, short-acting and long-acting. And then within those, we've got the two main receptors that allow for bronchodilation in the airway, and those would be the beta agonists or also our muscarinic antagonists. So you're going to hear us use the word LABA and LAMA today. We're probably about to get into more alphabet soup. But when LABA refers to the long-acting beta agonist, and LAMA refers to the long-acting muscarinic antagonist. And then you can probably pick your favorites off the list. I'm sure there's stuff on there you recognize. There may be some that you don't recognize. There have been a few new combinations, and we're going to talk about that, available on the market, and perhaps a few new medications within the last couple of years that maybe you're not as familiar with.
Yeah.
And then from the anti-inflammatory perspective, we have inhaled steroids. Now, inhaled steroids alone are not FDA approved for maintenance therapy in COPD, but inhaled steroids or ICS in combination with long-acting beta agonists or in we're going to refer to in this presentation as triple therapy or triple combination, where you have inhaled steroids with long-acting muscarinic antagonist or beta agonist. Those two classes or groups of medications are FDA approved in the U.S. for maintenance therapy in COPD. And then finally, we have a few other interesting agents, and we're just going to call those other oral agents. Yep. There is a PDE4 inhibitor that's been approved in the U.S., and it's important to remember for that medication, it's really just patients with chronic bronchitis and frequent exacerbations. I see a lot of patients coming into my office that really are probably not benefiting because they really don't fit that profile. And then while it's not FDA approved, I do want to mention azithromycin because, as you know, Fernando, we were involved in an NIH-sponsored study, which did show that azithromycin, when added to standard inhaled therapies for COPD, did also result in exacerbation reduction. So that's something else to consider as well.
All right. So we have a whole series of drugs, inhaled, oral, and then various components of the inhaled. We're going to drill down to some of those components now. And so you can see that bronchodilators have been around for a long time, and they're really one of the major components of therapy. So can you provide us, Melan, a sense of where you think globally and a little bit more specifically bronchodilators have a role in our COPD patients?
So bronchodilators are really considered the backbone of therapy for COPD. If you look at the GOLD treatment recommendations, it's sort of the short-acting bronchodilators, the first thing you would initiate in a patient who is minimally symptomatic. But once they start having persistent symptoms, a long-acting bronchodilator, either alone or in combination with the two types, is really going to bring you improvements in FEV1 symptoms and exacerbation. So it's, like I said, I consider it sort of the backbone of COPD therapy.
All right. And so give me a sense of both of you. In fact, I'm going to pose this one over to you, Matt, because we were talking about before this, we formally started about this issue of combinations. How do you view combinations, and how do you think your primary colleagues view combinations of these bronchodilators of two different classes?
Yeah, it's a great question because I think in general, most clinicians, primary care included, usually like to have a stepwise approach. And so we sort of start with one and add another medication. We don't usually start with combinations. We know that combination therapy may give us better efficacy, but we're sometimes worried about side effects. I think one of the differences in the respiratory medications, and we'll see some combination studies in just a second, is that when you're that the bronchodilators in combination don't seem to cause any excess side effects compared to placebo or the individual components alone. So I think using bronchodilators in combination, starting with that is something that I don't think my colleagues are used to, and there's probably a lot of underutilization of combination bronchodilators in patients that are really symptomatic. If we're focusing on symptoms and we see a patient that's really symptomatic, sometimes it might be wise to start with that combination therapy.
Right. Meilan, what about LABAs or safety issues with LABAs? What about that?
So I think, as far as I'm aware, there is not really a strong safety signal for LABAs in COPD. Much of the concern and some of the black box warnings that have been associated with medications in the past has been related to studies in asthma.
So
I feel quite comfortable with the safety data for LABAs in COPD. LABAs alone have been approved by the FDA for maintenance therapy in COPD, as well as LABA-LAMA in combination. Yeah. So I feel very comfortable with both.
Matthew?
I think I would add, as you mentioned, that those box warnings were in asthma. In asthma, in combination with inhaled steroid, actually data recently that's been recently published shows that actually those warnings are no longer warranted, and those box warnings have actually now been removed.
But I think a lot of people aren't aware of that.
A lot of people are not aware of that. So I think, you know, LABAs for asthma in combination with ICS, I think, are very, very safe, and certainly in COPD, that has not yet been an issue. So I think doctors should be comfortable with LABA prescriptions.
All right, so perfect. So the next component, Meilan, because I want you to try to bring all this together for us again, is this global obstructive lung disease GOLD recommendation regarding therapeutic approaches, symptoms, exacerbations. You guys have both mentioned that. You brought on some of these classes and different agents. So what do you think? There's the schema on the slide for these individuals. So give us an initial start, and then I want you to provide us a more practical view of this, Matthew. Meilan?
So I think LABAs or LAMAs, or in cases where patients are quite symptomatic in combination, is a great starting position for any patient with COPD. But then as kind of life goes on and you see the patient back, that's why GOLD realizes that you need to, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, this concept of a management review cycle where you bring the patient back. And I always, you know, when I see the patient back, I ask them about their symptoms, you know, feel like they can do more. And I also ask about exacerbations. Have you had any events either here or maybe another hospital that I'm not aware of? And so once I get a sense for what the problem is, dyspnea or exacerbations, then I can further tailor. I would say the one sort of, I think kind of the overarching theme, which is maybe a little bit different than what we've seen in the past, is the concept of going up, but also the concept of either going back or maybe transitioning to something parallel, like LABA ICS to LABA LAMA, with a little bit of room to kind of try something, reassess, and see how patients are doing. But it's usually kind of this sort of stepwise approach where the ICS are really focusing on patients who are having either symptoms despite dual bronchodilator or having persistent exacerbations despite dual bronchodilator.
So you deal with a lot more chronic illnesses than we do, and hypertension, diabetes. You guys are very used to this concept. We've tried to simulate some of that in this kind of an algorithm. What's your primary care expert sense?
It's interesting. I mean, this algorithm, if you just face value, actually looks really complicated, but it's actually not that hard.
Yeah.
You know, I think what the new data that this guideline is generated from new data, and I think if you go back 5 or 10 years before some of these products and some of this data existed, I think in primary care, you know, especially recognizing some of the old LABA safety concerns, you know, primary care physicians were either LAMA or ICS LABA.
Right.
You sort of saw a COPD patient, you had one of these two, and then, you know, and a primary care physician would sort of choose their favorite, not really thinking about necessarily symptomatology or risk. I think this is a real paradigm shift that you're saying, okay, I'm looking at risk for exacerbation, I'm looking at symptoms. If my patient is symptomatic primarily, then I'm going to start with bronchodilators, either single bronchodilator or dual bronchodilator. If I have a patient that's at risk of exacerbation, Certainly bronchodilators, especially the muscarinics, can show reduction exacerbation. And if there's more concern, that's when the inhaled steroids. So I think it really is a big shift.
Yep.
It's not that complicated. It's looking at exacerbation, looking at symptomatology, looking at the available agents that treat, that focus on both of those, and making a decision.
I love that summary. That's a really good summary. So I'm going to show you now. I told you that we had some of these videos that had been created, which I think are actually pretty cool. And I'm going to show you three of these. I hope I can do this correctly. And I'm going to have Matthew discuss the first one and Milan the next two. So Matthew, you get the entire chest there.
Very good. So this is a very nice animation of sort of what a normal lung, normal heart functions. You know, all of us as clinicians took anatomy, so this is not a new concept or topic. As Fernando mentioned, these videos will be available to you, but also for you to share with your patients. So this is probably maybe something that showing a patient might benefit. And I think in the context of COPD, it's important to note the importance, the connection between the heart and the lungs, that we know that chronic respiratory diseases, based on the anatomy and the physiology, can have downstream impact on the heart. And that is an important component, that we're not just talking about improving lung function or improving symptoms, but improving the whole picture, which could include cardiovascular disease.
And you're actually going to show one of these studies in a second. So Milan, you get the second two of these videos. And the first is just a video that shows sort of a unit of the bronchioles with alveoli, and it will be one that talks about short-acting bronchodilation.
So here you can see the short-acting bronchodilator medication heading down the airway into the alveolus that ultimately reduces hyperinflation. And it's the hyperinflation in COPD that's really responsible for a lot of the shortness of breath and the symptoms patients have, not just at rest, but also with exercise, where they get dynamic hyperinflation and the problem just gets worse and worse and worse.
Yep.
So this kind of shows you the benefit you get with the short-acting bronchodilator, and then I think the next video...
Yeah, and if you saw this, is pretty cool, because there was improvement in hyperinflation, then it got worse when the short-acting agent
wore off.
And this is now the long-acting agents.
And so here again, you can see deposition into the terminal airway with reduction in hyperinflation. And as Matt's going to talk about it in a minute, that can have impacts not just on helping the lungs function better, but also potentially other organs as well.
Yeah, so and like I said, there are actually five or six other videos that we just don't have time to show you that are equally as cool, but they show you sort of the concepts. So you guys have both talked about this issue of single versus dual bronchodilation, because remember, we have the LABAs and the LAMAs and the combination. Milan, can you share some of the insights regarding why you would consider a dual versus a single? This is physiology. It's lung function related.
So the data, I think, is pretty clear that with the duals as compared to the singles, you get improvements certainly in lung function, and that's what you're seeing here. And these are both medications that are, the combinations are both approved here in the U.S. for maintenance treatment in COPD. But you'll, again, in the left panel, see that the addition of olodaterol really improves lung function to tiotropium, and the same on the right-hand panel with umeclidinium and flantrol.
All right, so duals do improve lung function. They improve quality of life better. So, Matthew, the next one is a series of, I'm familiar with these since I published a couple of these papers, but it's the concept that the more symptomatic you are, the more likely that a dual up front is going to improve symptoms. What do you think? Does that resonate?
I think that resonates. It's intuitive. It's the more symptomatic you are, the more help you're going to need to improve those symptoms. I think the other key piece in my mind, which I think I alluded to before, is that we tend to think of additive medicines, additive benefit, but also at the expense of additive side effects.
Yeah.
And you really don't see that with the bronchodilators, that the addition of the combination of LAMA-LABA does not have more side effects than either alone or placebo. They're actually very low in side effect profile, and they've been studied extensively multiple times. So getting comfortable with the idea of maybe initiating with a combination therapy in a symptomatic patient makes a lot of sense. This data that you just presented, that you did, you know, supports that.
Yeah, I think that's really a paradigm that we've seen in the COPD world. It's using doubles up front. Matthew, you brought up in the video the heart and the lung in the same chamber there. Give us a sense of how that could potentially interact.
Exactly. So we've known for some time that, you know, severe chronic respiratory disease can impact the heart, and there's that connection. We now have recent data, you know, that was published in Lancet about whether therapy actually improved that. So this was a study, it was a double-blind, placebo-controlled crossover study with a LABA-LABA combination, endocaterol and glycopyridium. And what I looked at is heart effects. So you see in this slide, you can see improvement in left ventricular end-diastolic function. You see improvement in stroke volume. And then you also see a decrease in residual volume in the lung.
Yep.
So you have a respiratory medicine, not surprisingly, showing decreased hyperinflation that we saw in the video. Improvements of that, that's good to see. That's not so surprising.
Right.
What is surprising, what's new and different, is we're actually seeing improvement in cardiac function,
right,
too. And that could have potential benefits in terms of mortality and other things.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've seen this whole, this is why there's been a push towards dual bronchodilation, as Matthew said, in the COPD field. I want to switch to something a little bit different now, which is inhaled steroids. So you brought this up earlier in one of your comments, Matthew, regarding inhaled steroids for exacerbation component. So I'm going to present one piece of information then, Milan. I'm going to turn it over to you for a separate component, because we've been in the middle of this controversy regarding when inhaled steroids would be used in COPD. And this is what, this was a Sentinel study that was published a couple of years ago, which was a study of indacaterol, glycopyrronium, dual bronchodilation, a LABA and a LAMA, and an inhaled steroid LABA. And that was salmeterol fluticasone. And the study was trying to test which of those combinations would be better on exacerbations. And in fact, the dual bronchodilation worked better. So we were all, wow, that is an impressive component. Should we use inhaled steroids in this setting if dual bronchodilations have that effect? So that was called the FLAME study, followed by a study that Milan and I were both involved in, which was called the IMPACT study. Milan, I'm going to let you bring up that study so that you can see some of the concepts.
Sure. I think a lot of people were surprised by the FLAME data. I think in the U.S. we've certainly thought about inhaled steroids for exacerbation reduction a lot, and a lot of physicians I know often will use ICS-LABA combination as first line. So I think that was somewhat surprising. The IMPACT study replicated some of the arms of FLAME. It had the LAMA-LABA arm. It also had a LABA-ICS arm. What makes FLAME a little bit different that we're going to talk about in a minute is it also had the triple combination as well. But if you're just looking at the dual combinations, the LABA-LAMA versus the LABA-ICS, I think it does help us, it gives additional insights to the FLAME data as to which patients might actually benefit more from the inhaled steroid and which patients benefit more from the dual bronchodilator. So the first lines of data you'll see there is that in patients with really frequent exacerbations. And one thing I want to emphasize is that this FLAME population, or sorry, that the IMPACT population was a really sick patient population. But in the patients that were the sickest of this group, those who had two or more moderate or one or more severe, those are the ones that benefited the most from having the ICS inhaled steroid component. The other really interesting thing that they did was to compare patients by prior treatment. And one of the things that is sort of interesting about FLAME is that all patients were put on tiotropium for a month before they got into a study. So they had to kind of survive, if you will, that 4-week period before they go into the study. In other words, they had to be stable on a bronchodilator. So if you try to, whereas the IMPACT study just switched people immediately from what they'd been on to the study drug. So if you look at patients, though, who were previously on a long-acting muscarinic antagonist to sort of simulate the FLAME study, it's interesting, those patients actually did fine on a dual bronchodilator. And so what that tells me is that there are types of patients who probably do quite well, even with respect to exacerbation reduction, with a dual bronchodilator. And there are some patients who clearly need an inhaled steroid. And the physicians in this study knew.
Yeah, yeah.
The treating physicians knew. And so I think the onus is on some of us as investigators to try to figure out, and we're going to talk about more of this today, how do we figure out who those inhaled steroid responsive patients are?
Correct. And so, I mean, I think that was the key to all this. It's patient selection. Dual bronchodilators are great. If you are a greater burden, as you said, that's when inhaled steroids have the effect. But Matthew, you brought up something earlier that I think our primary care colleagues are quite familiar with, and that is this issue of pneumonia risk with inhaled steroids. Can you give some of the latest insights regarding that?
Yeah. So as I said before, everything that we do in medicine, whether it's cholesterol, diabetes, any treatment that we give, we're always weighing the risk and the benefits. So we've seen here, we've just started to talk about the potential benefits of inhaled steroids and their role in reducing exacerbations, especially at those patients who are at risk for exacerbations. And we've previously talked about the importance of exacerbations. So that sort of tells us that this is an agent that we want to use. There have been some associations, though, with pneumonia. So how do we balance that risk?
Right.
So, and I think the answer is that while there is clearly a signal with pneumonia, it's low, and in comparison to the benefit that you'll get from inhaled steroids, and weighing that risk and benefit, sort of agreeing with sort of what the EMA's recommendation is that the benefit really of the inhaled steroids outweighs that risk. Certainly, there are patients who may be at high risk for pneumonia, you know, immunosuppressed patients, things like that, that you might want to back off and say, you know, I'm not going to use an inhaled steroid.
Yep.
But I think the vast majority of patients who have that exacerbation risk, you're probably going to want an inhaled steroid.
I think that's the summary. It's risk-benefit, and I think it's become much clearer now that in a patient, there are a lot of patients where the risk-benefit is favorable, and some it's not. So now, Maylon, I'm going to turn over to another very controversial topic in our area, and I wanted to see how this has been synthesized in the primary care world, and that is this idea of having triple inhaled, so a steroid, a long-acting antimuscarinic, a LAMA, and a long-acting beta agonist, a LABA, all in the same device. Give us a summary in the next couple of slides of some of the data that have been available.
So it's important to remember that this triple combination therapy, there is one product that's approved in the U.S. I think it's been approved within the last year or so. The first slide here that we've got is actually non-U.S., but it does give you a sense for what the effect of the triple is compared with either LAMA or LAMA and LABA. So in this particular slide, we can see that there is additive benefit for the triple with respect to exacerbation reduction compared to either LAMA or LAMA-LABA. So I think that's not some huge surprise.
Yep.
I think this is something clinicians have been doing for a long time, but with two different inhalers or three different inhalers as opposed to having it all in one device. I think on the
impact data, I think, are the ones.
Yeah,
that
the
I'm
impact data,
seeing,
and this is this so. This study was one of the few. Most of them compared either the triple to one of the two duals, but didn't have everything. This is one of the few studies that had everything. So it really, and because of the large number of patients, around I think approximately 10,000 patients, data from the study really has allowed us to kind of get some nuanced insights into which patients benefit the most from all of these various combinations. But you'll see here the impact data that there was exacerbation reduction with the triple compared to either LAMA-LABA or LABA-ICS. The other very, very surprised finding from this study, and Matt, we were talking about this later, was the mortality data. What's your primary care take on that?
I mean, this is huge. I mean, mortality improvement is very hard to show. Even in, you know, statin use, we think of, you know, statins, you know, prevent heart attacks, prevent strokes. Only in the sickest patients are you, I mean, it's very hard to show actual mortality benefit even for something like statins. I mean, there are very few things that save lives. I mean, smoking cessation being one of them.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to show mortality benefit. Even with diabetes medicines, we're just starting to see cardiovascular outcomes.
Exactly.
We see no mortality benefit for any of the many products that we prescribe for our patients for diabetes. So having a mortality benefit is something that we've seen a signal for before in other studies, and now in this large randomized trial, having that mortality benefit is really huge.
Yeah.
Because now you're talking about potentially, you know, life-saving, disease-modifying potential. So this is something that is, you know, part of the pun, but very impactful.
Yeah.
You know, you can actually potentially affect a patient's life with a therapeutic agent.
Yeah, no, and so yeah, so this wasn't a mortality study, so I think that's the limitation. But I think you're right. I mean, I think what we've realized when we've seen some of these data is depending on the population, those patients who are at sickest and potentially the highest risk, there actually is likely a mortality benefit in that population. But let me come back to a separate topic, something else that you've mentioned a couple times, Matthew, which is our comparisons to the cardiovascular and diabetes world, where at least in the latter, in diabetes, hemoglobin A1C, you got a biomarker. Another area in the COPD world where there's been a tremendous enthusiasm has been finding a biomarker of steroid responsiveness. And so circulating eosinophils has been one of the popular ones. Maylon, can you summarize a lot of data in one slide, and then I want to hear how you would incorporate this, Matthew?
Well, I think we've been struggling with how do we identify these inhaled steroid responsive patients. And so one idea that's been looked at more recently is whether eosinophil count can serve as a biomarker for identifying this patient. So on the left, we have a summary of some studies that were done with budesonide formoterol compared to formoterol. On the right is data from that IMPACT study that we were just talking about. And in both, what's really interesting is they both sort of converge on the same thresholds. Yeah. And I would say that at the level of 100 eosinophils or lower, there's not a lot of data to suggest that those patients benefit from inhaled steroids with respect to exacerbation reduction. I would say over 300, it's looking pretty strong. That's like where you really start to see these curves diverge. And I would say 100 to 300 is a little bit of a middle ground where, you know, there's perhaps some trial and error. But I think it is beginning to give us some guideposts.
Is something that you think that primary care would be able to incorporate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think this sort of brings it all together. I mean, we're talking first about symptoms and exacerbation and then therapies that can benefit both of those things, with the understanding that inhaled steroids seem to clearly benefit exacerbation and may, in a subset of very sick patients, even improve mortality. Yep. But at the same time, we're balancing this risk with pneumonia and other side effects. And how do we find those right patients, the patient that would benefit the most? I think eosinophils is a pretty good biomarker. Now, sometimes those are very complicated to use in primary care. I know you pulmonologists like to use FeNAO2, nitric oxide,
right,
you know, for studies like that, something like that. That's not a machine, whereas I
right.
think primary care physicians should easily get spirometry. There are some fancy tools that I just think isn't something that we can easily incorporate. But this, all of our patients, whether they're COPD or not, at least most of my patients have at least one CBC,
CBC
that's on file somewhere. So this is
yep.
not like something new that we have to order. We can just take out our chart, and in most cases for my colleagues, the electronic medical record, look at the last CBC, and we'll see what the eosinophil count is. It's a very easy thing to do. We don't have to do anything. We just have to look at a baseline, and that may help further identify those patients who would most benefit from inhaled steroids and those patients that maybe that's not the best choice.
All right, so let me transition this eosinophil to something that's a little bit similar to that, and that is, as we look at sort of the idea that you're going to reevaluate patients, and it's this idea of, and you know, this is something that you guys do routinely, you mentioned that you can, as you reevaluate the patient, you can consider whether you need to increase or whether you need to potentially decrease. And so with regards to decrease, the question that I now pose to you, Melana, can you give us some sense regarding the data that are recently available regarding the potential of withdrawing inhaled steroids? And so in this next presentation, take us through the two studies that have been available.
So this is kind of a new concept with GOLD that they just sort of introduced in this most recent iteration, this concept of review, assess, but also escalate and de-escalate. And so we do have some studies more recently that have helped us give us some guidance with respect to when de-escalation might be appropriate. So there's data from both the SUNSET study and the WISDOM study, which were both studies examining triple therapy, where the steroid was withdrawn, and then we were looking at the effect of the dual. And what's interesting is that when we look at the patient populations, as you can see in this slide, overall, there did not seem to be a spike in exacerbations with inhaled steroid withdrawal. So that's first of all, sort of interesting. This suggests potentially this is something that can be done safely. However, both of these studies went back and did some subcuts of the data.
Eosinophils again, Matthew.
And it looks like in one at around 300, in the other study perhaps around 400 eosinophils is where you start to see an uptick in exacerbation. So again, we're starting to accumulate some guidance when maybe it might be okay in, you know, in certain patients to start thinking about, do they really need the inhaled steroid?
So Matthew, in the specialty world has been this idea that if you are stable, you can potentially transition to a dual bronchodilator and not include inhaled steroid. That's an algorithm that's been published suggesting that. What do you think? Do you think it's something that could be operationalized for you?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the algorithm that's in the slide, again, it looks rather complex, but it's actually not that hard. You have a patient, you're reviewing them, you're assessing them, they're stable. They haven't had exacerbation, their symptoms are clinically improved when you start therapy. They've been on therapy for a long period of time. In your assessment, you know, do they need to be on what they're on, or can you step down? I think if they're on triple therapy or they're on ICS-LABA and they're stable, you know, I think besides the stability, looking at that eosinophil count is something that's reasonable to do before you consider stepping down. On the other hand, you know, we say if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Yeah,
so you have to be careful. But I think this gives us a tool the eosinophil count in particular, to help us make that decision.
Yeah, and I think Matthew's points are absolutely correct. And I think all of us have been wrestling what to do with this. How long stable? You know, what are the questions? Is it 3 months? Is it 6 months? But I think that the paradigms of stepping down are paradigms that are starting to become more accepted. In the last 10 minutes or so, I want to pose something that is equally important, and I don't want to shortchange it, and that is the complexity that's present in with regards to adherence to our medications. And so I'm going to start off with you, Matthew, and ask you what your sense is from the primary care world regarding adherence in the COPD population.
Well, as the slide shows, and we know from clinical experience, that a lot of our patients just won't stick with therapy, that yeah. they'll stop their prescription within the first month. And even those that are adherent who stay on medication, over time that adherence declines. So it's really important that we focus on not just what medications to pick, which we spent some time talking about, but yep. making sure that the patients actually take the medicines
exactly.
and take them correctly. Because
yep.
if they're not, it doesn't matter what we pick
matter.
If they're not
exactly.
taking it correctly. So it's about education. It's about making sure that they understand that this is not something that they're going to be on for a short period of time, but
yep.
for a very long, every day, making sure that they train, that they use proper inhaler techniques. One of the things that I do in my clinic, which I know you in academics, it might in some academic settings may be difficult.
Yeah.
I actually use the samples. I initiate therapy. The sample is really useful as a teaching tool. I'll have them use the medication. I'll teach the technique. I'll have them demonstrate it, take the actual medication. And then there's some reinforcement, especially if it's a bronchodilator, which these newer ones tend to kick in about 15 minutes. I'll say, you know, by the time you get to the parking lot, you're probably going to start feeling something.
And that
can reinforce that, yes,
I
this medicine
is working.
So that's generally what I do if you have the luxury of having samples, which fortunately in private practice I do.
All right. So let me extend this in a different way. So there are a lot of devices that we now have. I mean, it's a good thing because we have a lot of options. But we've got, you know, meter dose inhalers, drought pattern inhalers, mist nebulizers, and all of these components. And that has led Melon to an understanding that the devices themselves can be very difficult to use. And in fact, in some of the more frequent devices, it's very common to see misuse of these inhalers. What do you want to tell your primary care colleagues with this soup of devices?
Well, I think there's a common set of errors that patients can make, and that, you know, it either has to do with inappropriate timing, they may have limitations due to arthritis or neurocognitive issues, or it may be that they simply aren't able to pull enough to actually generate the force needed to get it, say, a dry powdered inhaler. And so I think it's important to watch the patients, see what they're doing, and you know, as part of that management review cycle, recheck. You know, maybe the medication's been changed by the pharmacy and you didn't even know it. Or the patient seems to be failing their regimen. Is it that that's really the wrong regimen? Is it that they aren't using it correctly? Can they be trained to use it correctly?
Right.
And if not, if that there's just no way to get that, you know, then you get a new fit. You find a different device.
So Matthew, these next two slides, and we're almost at the very end here, guys. I'm going to have you repeat a couple of key concepts because I think you've provided such practical data. So the next is give us a sort of a bullet summary for our clinicians on sort of key points when they're trying to decide on devices.
Well, one is it has to be access. And that, you know, a lot of the decisions we make, you know, we can debate all the stuff about what's the right choice. At the end of the day, it's can the patient afford it? Is there on their formulary?
Yep,
so knowing that, making sure that they have access to that, and then even if it's on the formulary, that the cost, the copay, the out-of-pocket cost is not too high. If it costs them too much money, they're just not going to take it. So that's really key and critical. The second thing is inhaler technique, as Melon was talking about. This is like why I use the sample, so that I can see with my eyes that the patient is using it correctly, and I can reinforce correct techniques or correct incorrect techniques, and also have them come back, have them reassess their techniques.
So, exactly.
You know, we in primary care are pretty good at chronic disease management, having patients come in, sort of checking on their things.
Yep.
And so one of the things in a COPD patient, besides symptomatology and exacerbation, which we talked about, is are their inhalers working? Is their technique correct?
Right. So in the next, the last point regarding this inhaled device, which I pose to both of you, how often do you have patients come back and follow up? How often do you retrain? Melon, you first, and then you get the last point there, Matthew.
I typically bring patients back every 3 to 6 months, depending on how they're doing.
Yeah.
I will admit I probably don't retrain as often as I should, mostly because we have busy workflow, right? So it's challenging.
Yep.
I'm fortunate I do have staff that are all very, you know, we've got all the demos and everything. I always do it at the first, and if there's a switch. But I am still working on, I think, trying to, ideally you would do it essentially with every visit.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I think the 3 to 6 months seems sort of intuitively right. There's not, I think, a lot of data to support
right, but
it makes a lot of sense.
What we do.
And try to tell the patient to remember to bring their device at the next visit, and that way you don't have to get an extra staff person. You know, to do that, you can do it right there in the visit. It takes literally three seconds.
Let me ask you one last question regarding this, Matthew, because I want to see how you deal with this. The patient calls you and says, my pharmacy, my insurance has changed, and I no longer have that device. The pharmacy told me to use this one. What do you do with that?
Oh, that's a really complex question. We often in primary care, we're getting these calls from the pharmacist, and sometimes we view them as the bad guys. But really, they're just doing their job. It's sort of shooting the messenger. Yeah. Even the busy community pharmacist at the CVS or Walgreens is trained in these kind of things.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think there's two options. One is have them go to the pharmacist. You know, once you go through the prior authorization and get the right device, the pharmacist is designed. There's that little window with consultation with the pharmacist. It's supposed to do something. So we can use our pharmacy colleagues, our pharmacist colleagues, to do what they're educated to do. The other thing is that, you know, again, it depends on your patient age and demographics. Most of the products, if you go to the company's website, there are these videos that take you step by step on how to use that.
Yeah.
So I've often used that too, where I say, go to the company's website, click on this link, and you'll see a video. I think the pharmacist is probably the better option though, and I think we see them as the bad guys sometimes. We shouldn't really shoot the messenger.
Yes.
They hate prior auth as much as we do. So.
If there are pharmacists out there, see, we love you. There actually have been controlled trials that suggest that pharmacists actually do a remarkably good job of training patients. So, Milan, you're going to get the last slide here, because I don't want the participants to think that all we ever do with patients with COPD is
throw inhalers at them.
And so can you bring up a couple of the concepts regarding some key non-pharmacological things that must be considered?
Yeah, obviously smoking cessation is probably the number one most important thing we can do. Encouraging good diet, physical activity, good weight, which can be a problem for COPD patients. They're under or over. Vaccines, flu, pneumococcal, but no talk about COPD would be complete without a discussion of pulmonary rehabilitation. In addition to smoking cessation is probably the second most important thing we can do. Fortunately, with CMS coverage, patients from gold to and more severe are actually covered. So there are a good number of patients that should be covered under Medicare to attend a rehab program. What is rehab exactly? It's comprehensive. It's aerobic exercise. It's strength training, upper and lower body. And then it's a lot of education, breathing exercises, pursed lip breathing, how to take your medications. It's sort of like your all-in-one go-to for just making sure the patients understand their medications, understand their disease, understand when to call. Mm-hmm. There's just so many benefits for rehab, and I think it's grossly underutilized. So that would be one of my plugs for this discussion.
All right. Well, actually, speaking of plugs. I'm going to leave you in the audience with the following component. A charge to you two with regards to what to leave. So we have covered a lot of stuff today, and I appreciate your sitting there and listening to all that during lunchtime, at least on the East Coast. And I wanted to make sure that we summarized some of the action items and provided you with SMART goals that you could do today. So SMART, remember, stands for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. So I want each of you to provide our audience with three of these goals that meet those SMART criteria, starting with you.
So I would challenge my primary care colleagues to really do a better job of assessing patients for symptoms. So not just, you know, are you a smoker? Okay, but did you used to smoke? Do you have risk factors, secondhand smoke? Is this a potential patient who's at risk? And then what are your symptoms? Do you have cough, dyspnea, shortness of breath? We're very busy in primary care. It literally only takes a second to recognize those patients that might have COPD so that we can make the diagnostic. Yeah. And that leads to the second bullet point that I would add, is that you can't make the diagnosis without spirometry. And this is not a complicated device. This is something that costs very little that we can easily incorporate into primary care. These devices are a lot less expensive, a lot bulkier, easy to use. So I would challenge my patients, my primary care colleagues, to consider adding spirometry to your practice, because it's really necessary for both the diagnosis and management of both COPD and asthma, which is something that we see a lot of in primary care.
And the device has EKG and spirometry.
Yeah, I have a very good one. And then finally, you know, exacerbations. And again, the parallel that I use is that the exacerbation for COPD is like the heart attack for cardiovascular disease. So we really have to, just like we're trying to do all the things that we do with high blood pressure and cholesterol to prevent heart attacks, we should do the same thing with preventing exacerbations. And the best way to prevent exacerbations is to identify if the patient has exacerbated, because, you know, the greatest predictor of an exacerbation is a previous exacerbation. So really assess for those exacerbations, particularly that patient who has not yet been diagnosed but keeps coming back with these, oh, these are my regular bronchitis. I get it a couple times each season. No one has regular bronchitis. They're probably a COPD patient. We got to identify those patients.
Those are three beautiful goals that meet the SMART criteria. Milan, you're three now.
I think the first would be to think about this management review cycle. So when the patients come in, think about their medications. Are these working for those patients? And get them retrained on devices. Get them trained the first time. But if you end up making a switch, get them retrained. I will put in a little plug for the COPD Foundation. They've got a great website, a great free app. It actually has links to unbranded videos of how to use the devices. So that's a great, I'm just going to put that out there as a good resource for physicians. Gold also, I guess I should be in Fair Balance, Gold also has an app. The second I think would be to expand your repertoire of treatment options, not just for the sake of expanding, but there are some new options beyond perhaps what I had in training. Yeah. And those would include the dual bronchodilators. I think they're safe and there's definitely a place for them. And now more recently, the triple therapy that's all available in one inhaler. And that may be appropriate for some of our sicker patients. So I think it's good to be aware and to be comfortable with using the treatment options that we have. And then, as I mentioned before, of course, I can't not have a talk on COPD and just mention the importance of pulmonary rehabilitation. I know this can be a bit of a struggle for patients with respect to transportation, but I think, you know, usually they can get in one session and figure out a way to continue the exercises at either at home or at a local facility. But it's comprehensive education, aerobic activity, et cetera, and patients love it. Patients just love it.
She runs a really good pulmonary rehab program, so I got to give a plug to that one. So so you've gotten six, three from each, sort of challenges, goals for you. Remember, in a couple of months, CME Outfitters is going to be querying you again about whether you've had a chance to be able to introduce some of these. I encourage you to visit the CME Outfitters website for a comprehensive list of clinical resources, additional educational activities for providers and patients. It includes animations, including the ones that we've used today and more of the ones that we've generated, slides, and really a whole lot more. CME Outfitters is also on YouTube, so you can check out the activities, patient education that's there. And really, it's now time to turn this over to you. And you're the viewers that I hear from my little earphone that you've asked a lot of questions already. Okay, welcome back, and we're going to tackle some of your questions. There are several sheets of these, you guys have asked some really good questions. And as I told Matthew, since he's the primary care guy, he gets the hardest question of all. So, Matthew, we haven't talked about COPD versus asthma. So how do we separate those two, and does it make a difference?
That's a fantastic question.
That's why I said the easiest one to you.
I think specialists probably have these debates all the time of where is the overlap and how do you define it? You know, I think in the primary care setting, we see the overlap probably more commonly. So in a smoker that has asthma, is that COPD? I think the idea that these are two separate entities and they never interact is probably an old concept, that there's probably, we know, for example, that untreated asthma, over time, you have this reversible airway wall remodeling that the definition even of asthma change, so that while asthma is a reversible disease, it's not necessarily complete, right, which leads to this concept that asthma turning into COPD. Yep. So untreated asthma over time can turn into COPD. And certainly there's an inflammatory component in COPD. You know, we talked about eosinophils. We usually think about eosinophils as something that's related to asthma. So I think, you know, there are tons of different phenotypes too. So I think you have to approach each patient individually and recognizing that there's probably more overlap than we think. Certainly if you're thinking asthma, you know, as we mentioned, sort of the, I think the difference is that with COPD, the cornerstone of therapy is bronchodilation. With asthma, the cornerstone of therapy is anti-inflammatories, is inhaled corticosteroids. And so when there's that overlap, you know, you have to think about if you have a COPD patient, which you think there may be an asthma component, you're probably going to want to make sure that there's an inhaled corticosteroid on board. I think that's really how to simplify that whole process.
That was excellent. That's really the practicalities. You're absolutely correct. We have this argument all the time, and it essentially comes back to asking a primary care guy what's the most practical way of doing this. So let me ask a second question. There are a lot of questions here, guys, and I apologize, but there's one that we really did overlook. Couldn't think of the word. And that is, we didn't talk about the role of a respiratory therapist. And the person says, we can do so much to help these patients. Yep, absolutely correct. Meilan, do you want to tackle that one first?
Yeah, we utilize respiratory therapists throughout the institution. We've got them at our pulmonary rehab facilities doing training and education. We've elicited them on the inpatient teams, not just to do NMTs, but we've really now have them do a lot of the patient discharges, making sure the patients know how to use their medication and doing that last bit of training before they leave. We now, and I'm really excited about this, and I realize this is a complete luxury. I now also have a respiratory therapist with me in clinic for the COPD patients. And that's been a huge help, particularly for patients who are more severe and may be on assistive respiratory devices and things like that. So it's a great pickup. I love my respiratory therapist, and
correct.
I'm lucky to get to work with a lot of them. They are key partners in the care of COPD patients.
Yeah, respiratory therapists in the hospital setting are crucial components of the multidisciplinary team. There's no question about it. And there are a few centers who have the luxury of having respiratory therapy in the outpatient arena. There have been a whole series of studies regarding the training of patients in inhaler use, for example. Respiratory therapists usually come at the top. Pharmacists, we got a pharmacist, at least one out there, are up there as well, but respiratory therapists really are the ones that are known to be the best educators in that respect. So that was an oversight, clearly, on our part. But there was also a comment from a retail pharmacist who appreciates your comments there, Matthew, and he notes that they spend a lot of time teaching patients, and they're always shocked that the patient, when they show up, haven't received any prior education before they see them.
So we all are in this together. We all have to work together.
It's part of the multidisciplinary team. So one of the questions that individual raises is that, and so listen to the way this was worded and see how you would address this. A hard part of teaching compliance is that the patient may not get better while using some of the inhaled medications, particularly steroids. And the emphasis is not to get worse over time. How do we simplify that message?
That's really hard. That's a really challenging question. I think, you know, for COPD, we're not using inhaled steroids by itself. So they may not notice the improvement of the inhaled steroids.
Right.
It's just like, you know, unfortunately, we don't have that sort of parameter. We don't have, like, when I start a cholesterol medicine, I can say, oh, look, your LDL number went down. You don't feel anything,
but
at least I can show you that number. So we don't really have that. So I think the use of combination, you know, inhaled steroid with either, you know, a LABA or even triple therapy, it's having those agents making the patient feel better.
Okay.
But it's all about education. It's about we're going to, you know, we want to prevention. People understand prevention. So even if it doesn't make them feel better, we want to keep you out of the hospital. We want to prevent you from having an exacerbation. We want to prevent you from getting sick again. And again, in some cases, we want to prevent you from dying.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So death is a pretty scary thing. Yeah. And so, you know, patients are motivated to take medication based on can they afford it, how easy it is there side effects, and how much it's going to benefit them. So it's a great opportunity to educate patients, but it's an excellent point. It's not easy to do.
I think one of the issues is that patients, probably their first introduction to inhalers, albuterol.
Correct.
And so they get used to the fact that they're going to get immediate relief from an inhaler. They immediately tie that symptom relief to taking the medication. And I think we as physicians don't always take that next step. We say, but there might be some that I'm going to prescribe you where you may not have some immediate effect. And you still need to take it just like your antihypertensive, even if you don't notice something within the first 15 minutes.
So let me pose a question to you, because we had this discussion earlier on regarding some of these videos that have been generated by CME Outfitters, which include these videos that can be used for patients. Mm. So I'm going to show you a video, and I want you to see how you could potentially use this video in an educational capacity for the patient. I'm not sure if you guys, so I'm going to choose this one. Let me see if I can get that one correctly. So if you demonstrate in this kind of a video the concept that by providing an inhaled steroid-containing regimen with the bronchodilation, that there is a decrease in hyperinflation and a decrease in the redness, the inflammatory component, could that potentially be used to demonstrate to patients the added effect of adding the steroid in that setting?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the patients sometimes don't. I mean, we all dissected a body and have looked at slides, and the patients sometimes don't have a real concept of what goes on. And so showing these videos to patients, I think, can be very helpful. And, you know, you can use also words like inflammation, fire, red. Yeah. It's putting out the fire. Those type of analogies, I think, can be very, very helpful to the patient. The other thing, you know, more also with asthma too, it's like, you know, the disease is always there, whether you feel it or not. So you're trying to prevent it and keep it. And I think these videos can be useful, you know, at least in discussing with patients.
You can download them. They're for use with patients as well. All right. So I'm going to read a couple of questions directly.
Okay.
Because they're really summary of an entire hour's worth of discussion. So the first was, how do you stage therapies in patients? And this individual says, I have a very busy family practice. And where do you start with a newly diagnosed patient? Should I start with dual therapy? I want to be aggressive, but not too aggressive, and get them the medication they need.
So, so this is where I think these sort of new guidelines can help us a little bit. And again, while the first, you know, the latest guidelines do start talk about monotherapy in those boxes, they also suggest that you can start with dual therapy. So even though it may not be in the box or the diagram, starting with dual therapy is certainly easy. I'm like that too. I'm busy and I like to try to keep things simple. So I think about, you know, are they symptomatic or are they at risk for an exacerbation or both? And if they're symptomatic, I like to start them on bronchodilators. And I think starting on a dual bronchodilator, that tends to be my preference. And the reason why is because I know that I can achieve better lung function, better symptomatology without the additional risk of side effects.
Yep.
So it's opposite of to our normal paradigm where we start with one medication and then we can progressively add. And with COPD, it's not, we don't have as many, while lung function is an objective measure that categorizes things, we're really basing treatment on symptomatology. So if a patient is in an MRC of 2 or greater, I'll probably start them on a dual bronchodilator. If they've had a recent exacerbation or they have a history of exacerbation, I know that they're at risk for exacerbation.
Yep.
So I will probably also add an inhaled corticosteroid.
Yep.
So the real new way that I think about COPD is, again, this is just in my practice, or is do I do dual bronchodilator therapy, LABA/LAMA, or do I do triple therapy? And that makes it very, very simple for me in primary care.
That is really where the practicality comes from. And I think that's one of the key points that I think we want to provide to you is that, as Meilan said, you have a repertoire of medications to use that probably should be expanded a bit within the context of the patient that's in front of you. Let me pose a separate question. I'll read it directly, Meilan. This is from a nurse practitioner who says, why wouldn't we use triple therapy in all patients if we prevent or prolong constriction? These are good questions.
These are good questions, and trust me, long debates about this. I think it, again, comes back to the whole kind of risk-benefit discussion. So I don't think all patients, for instance, need an inhaled steroid.
Yeah.
And certainly there are some risks. We talked about risk for pneumonia. But there's also, if you think about it, COPD is not a disease of 5 years. In many patients, a disease of 20 to 30 years. And there are some side of things that we didn't talk about that are associated with long-term inhaled steroid use, things like cataract development, potentials for skin thinning. But there is the, you know, potential for bone thinning as well. So I like to not initiate a medication if I don't have to, particularly the inhaled steroid. So for me, I definitely use it when I have to. And there's certainly some patients who are having frequent events where you clearly need to. But I mean, we also talked today about withdrawal too. And for some patients, it may be appropriate. And I do try to get patients off inhaled steroids if I think it's appropriate, if they're having, you know, an issue like frequent pneumonia or something. So I would say that's probably, in my mind, the number one reason for not jumping to triple therapy in all patients. I do think that the discussion about single bronchodilator versus dual is sort of a more nuanced discussion,
right.
And I think you could argue that if for any one patient that, you know, that that either might be an appropriate choice.
Yep, I agree. So I'm going to ask you this next question. There are two of them that are related to this. We only have about 5 minutes left. I mean, there are more and more questions coming. So I'm sorry if I haven't gotten to yours. I'm trying to pick ones that overlap with multiple individuals asking. Can you talk about outcomes in smokers? How does smoking impact treatment decision, since a large portion of this individual's patients won't quit smoking despite my best efforts?
So I don't think smoking by itself affects treatment decision. In other words, you're going to base it on symptoms and exacerbations. Smoking is going to impact that, meaning if you continue to smoke, you're going to have more frequent symptoms. If you continue to smoke, you're going to have a more progressive decline in lung function. So I think you're going to go where the patient is based on symptoms and exacerbation risk, regardless of whether they smoke. I think what it does is it heightens the risk of the patient.
It
makes you want to maybe focus a little bit more aggressively. And also, obviously, you want to focus on smoking cessation. This is not exactly what you asked, but going back to what we talked about earlier in lung function, we talked about that the guidelines don't recommend routine screening.
Yes.
And the reason why they didn't recommend routine screening, because there was a study in smokers that looked at spirometry as a motivational tool for smoking cessation. And when using regular spirometry, that didn't really work. But after those guidelines were published, there was another study that looked at showing patients lung age. And lung age actually showed to be a motivator.
Yep.
So if you tell a patient, you're only, 80% of what you're supposed to be or 50% of what you're supposed to be, that doesn't resonate with them. But if you say, Mrs. Johnson, you're 65 years old, but your lungs are 85, they're like, whoa!
Yeah.
And that's my experience in clinic, and there was a trial that's supposed to. And again, these devices have gotten so sophisticated that when I, have my assistant put in some simple variables, instruct them to breathe correctly, when I get that printout, just like I get the EKG, it tells me that lung age. And I find that a big motivator for smoking cessation. So I don't think it changes, the quick answer to the question is, I don't think it changes your choice of pharmacotherapy, but it affects the pharmacotherapy that you're going to use because of the increased risk of exacerbation, increased symptomatology. The focus should be on smoking cessation. And spirometry may be a tool to get patients to stop smoking.
So we only have 2 minutes. I'm going to ask you this last question, Maylon, because it relates. Multiple people have asked this question, and it's the only non-FDA-approved indication that we talked about.
Oh, azithromycin.
And so can you? There are multiple questions regarding when to use it.
Yeah.
The smoking impact, she's actually published the only paper actually that addresses that. So can you give, in the last minute and a half, a summary of azithromycin?
Yeah, so the data suggests that azithromycin, when added to standard inhaled therapies, does reduce exacerbations. There's no specific phenotype of patient that doesn't necessarily respond, except for active smokers.
It's the only therapy in which that makes a difference.
But so that's a group I wouldn't try it on. Otherwise, I will try it and see. There are some caveats. I check an EKG first, and I check it afterwards. I consider a chest CT to make sure there's no evidence of atypical mycobacteria. And if the patient has any hearing impairment at baseline, I make sure to get routine hearing follow-up afterwards. So there are some extra caveats for safety, and we really don't know long-term safety data for azithromycin. But definitely, I think we've all got patients where they're still exacerbating despite being on every class of therapy that's FDA approved. And so it is something I will consider.
And azithromycin is independent of the eosinophil at this point.
Correct. As far as we know, we didn't have the data for that study.
So just remember, it's important to realize a lot of the nuances that Maylon said. On top of patients who are maximally treated with inhaled medications, so that's what Matthew has just been talking about, azithromycin may have a benefit. There are a whole bunch of caveats to its use. And so you do have to understand that even though we've mentioned it, and we're biased in favor, we were involved in the large NIH study that you paid for through your tax dollars, it has to be done with caveat. I'm being told that we have time for one more question. And so I will pick one last question that I think is relevant to what we're saying. So here's the question. Got a patient who is still having moderate dyspnea despite being on triple inhaled therapy. Oral steroids do help, but I don't want to give them long term. What can I do? Persistent dyspnea in a person on maximal inhaled therapy.
My first thought is rehab. That would be the first thing I'd recommend.
Rehab.
Right. So I think there are other tools. You just talked about azithromycin. Just you talked, mentioned briefly about PDE4 inhibitors. They're biologics that we haven't spoken about. For me in primary care, I think most of the COPD patients we can probably manage with the new techniques, but I don't have an RT in my clinic. I don't, you know, so this is the kind of patient that I would probably refer to a specialist, someone who's on maximal therapy who's still symptomatic. I agree, I don't want to put the patients on oral steroids too, but they may benefit from some of the resources and expertise as our pulmonary colleagues have. So that's the patient that I refer. If they're on triple therapy, I can't get them under control, that's the patient I'm going to send to you guys.
And remember, even though the lungs are the most important organ in the chest, the heart is also in there. I'd make sure that person doesn't
have
something
else. Yeah,
does
have comorbidities,
So again, I apologize that we were not able to take all of your questions. I mean, we have a page full of questions, all of which are very, very good. You guys obviously have been thinking about this topic. But remember to visit the CME Outfitters website. There are a lot of resources there, all the slides, animations that are present that hopefully will be able to provide you with additional insights as you mull this information over. And I appreciate both of you participating, and thank you for sticking it to the very end for those who are online. Thanks very much.